Okay, it is Thursday. It is about 4:30 in the afternoon, which means it is time for In the Cage with Bards, which is Vancouver's preeminent mixed martial arts program. And because I like to think that I'm part of the solution and not part of the problem, I am still Carlin Bardsley. A lot to talk about today. We've got results from the UFC Fight for the Troops card, as well as preview of the Strikeforce show coming out this weekend. But most importantly, we are joined now by the former Canadian heavyweight champion, the man who is synonymous with boxing in this country, member of the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame, the Boxing Hall of Fame, a member of the Order of Canada, never knocked down in 93 fights, the legendary Mr. George Schivalo. How are you today, George?
I'm okay, Carlin. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. And thank you for appearing on the program.
My pleasure.
Starting way back at the beginning, you got involved in amateur boxing growing up in Toronto, fighting at the old Earls Court Club back in my old neighborhood of St. Clair West. What drew you to the sport? Was any one thing in particular? Was it just a way to channel some energy? What was the initial appeal?
Well, the initial appeal was when I walked into a convenience store. It was called the Morgan Cigar Store, but it was more like a convenience store. And they had a magazine rack. This is back in the Junction area of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 7 years old, and I walked in there, and I saw a magazine rack, and I saw a magazine called The Ring. And it called itself The Bible of Boxing, as it does today. And I saw the page, on the front page, on the cover page, with fighters. I looked inside, and I said, oh, man, that's for me. I want to be a fighter. I saw these guys with muscles, and at seven, I wanted to be muscular, and I wanted to be a fighter. So I ran home and said, Mom, give me a set of boxing gloves. So she laughed and took her a couple of years before she got a set of gloves from Eaton's, big department store, and I would take the gloves with me diagonally across the street, up a laneway, and into the what we call the Macaroni Field, which is the unpaved parking lot in Lancia Macaroni. The Lancia Macaroni had a big pasta plant there. Anyway, I would take my gloves, I'd box with some of my buddies, and one day an older guy, when I say older guy, a guy maybe about 17 or 18, says, George, you're pretty good with your deuce, why don't you go to a gym? I said, where is there a gym? He says, at St. Mary's Polish Roman Catholic Church, about a mile away. And I went there, and there was an old professional called Mickey McDonald, who shared the same name as an infamous bank robber of those days. And he was a former pro, and he was a very nice guy, and he worked with us at the gym at church. And they used to have boxing there every day during the weekend, every night during the weekend, on the weekends during the day. And on Saturdays, they had dancing. Anyway, a new priest came in from Winnipeg, and he said Catholics don't dance and they don't box, so no dancing and no boxing. So I had to go find a new gym, and I found myself a couple years later over at the Earls Court Boxing Club, which is in your neck of the woods in Toronto.
That's right.
And that was it, and that's where I remained and stayed as a fighter until I turned pro. Then at the age of 18, I went to another gym, and I was still training at Earls Court every once in a while because that's where all my buddies were. But I would train primarily down at the Toronto Athletic Club down on Queen Street, not by Lake Ontario.
Excellent. Now, when did it occur to you that you might be able to make a career out of the sport?
Initially, even when you're like 7 years old, you think, oh, man, I'd love to be heavyweight champion of the world.
Sure.
We all have those dreams. I mean, most fighters start off that way, you know. I always thought about it. I always wanted to be strong. I always wanted to be muscular. I always wanted to be a fighter. I wanted to beat up people, I guess. Anyway, it seemed to me to be the purest form of sport, especially when you see a guy standing victorious over a fallen opponent and your hands up in the air. And, you know, it's just it's a very competitive, very raw, very, you know, life and death kind of situation, it seems like.
Sure.
You're in the ring. It's a tough business. Boxing is a tough business, and you have to take the good with the bad, and it's a lot of hard work. And no matter how much talent you have, you can be Muhammad Ali or Joe Louis, Sugar Ray Robinson. Doesn't make any difference if you don't train hard. If you don't put out in the gym, you're not going to make it. I don't care how much natural talent you have. So it takes a lot of hard work plus a certain amount of athleticism, and that's it. And you know, you have to have the right attitude. You have to have physically also have things working for you, you know, and you have to be dedicated, and discipline is such a strong part of training, such a strong part of athletics, And if you don't have discipline, then you're not going to make it. If you have discipline, you got a shot. But without it, you can't make it.
Absolutely. Now, you fought at a time when the heavyweight division was arguably at its peak in all of boxing. You fought all the top names, Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, George Foreman. Who was the best fighter you ever stepped in the ring with?
Well, I guess Ali was the best fighter I ever stepped in the ring with. I don't think he was a great puncher necessarily, but he was very quick of hand and foot and very intelligent, and he was a heck of a fighter. I mean, his record obviously speaks for itself, and he was a great fighter, and we had two tough fights, a 15-rounder and a 12-rounder. I fought him in the second round in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't champion of the world then. That's why the fight was only 12 rounds. But the first fight was 15 rounds, and I only had 17 days to prepare for it. I was a last-minute substitute for Ernie Terrell, who pulled out of the fight. And it was kind of a bit of a rush job. It was kind of like my imaginary date with Raquel Welch. I always laugh when I say to myself, it'd be like somebody would say, "Hey, George, you got a half an hour to get ready for Raquel." You know, this is why I was a single man, by the way. I'm not talking to man. And I'd say, "Oh man, I gotta get a shower. I gotta put my best suit on, best shirt and tie, shine my shoes, and get the best cologne, deodorant, and all that stuff." And you know, only got a half an hour, you know, so it's kind of like a rush job. So I felt kind of like that, waiting for this fight, because usually you gotta need a couple of months to get ready for a big fight, like a 15-rounder,
right.
So. You know, but it was a bit of a rush job, and I get opponents at the last minute. I had to call Detroit, I had to call guys in Miami, I had to call guys in New York City, and you know, just a matter of about 24 hours, it looked like I had a whole room full of sparring partners. But that's what I needed, and I was pretty good shape, just like walking around shape. When I say walking around shape, I was still within hitting distance of being in shape to go 15 rounds, because I always trained hard anyway. You know, I was always in the gym pretty well. I didn't take long layoffs necessarily, hardly, you know, or hardly ever. But so I was when I only had 17 days to prepare. Not that it was enough, but it still was enough for me to go 15 rounds at a fairly good pace. But I would have liked to live another month and a half. That would have been nice.
Well, any amount of time to prepare for Ali, you never know if it's enough, right?
Well, I mean, the better shape you're in, that always stands you in good stead in a fight. And the better shape you're in, it means you have more steam. You have more to deliver. And you're a more dangerous opponent when you don't get tired. You know, the fatigue is a factor in a fight, and that works against you if you're not ready, and then the fatigue takes over. You know, you're not going to do your best. You're not going to do well. And I did okay in the 15 round. I was still good enough shape to go at a pretty good pace. It was a hard fought fight, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
I always say it the same way. They say, "George, you lost the fight." I say, "Yeah, but guess who went to the hospital after the fight, and guess who went dancing with his wife?" Muhammad goes to the hospital, I went dancing with my wife. So.
And that's the real measure of who wins the fight, right? Who goes to the hospital and who goes dancing?
Who goes to the hospital? Loser always goes to the hospital, the way I see it.
Yeah. If Ali was the best guy you've ever fought, who hit you the hardest?
George Foreman, a big puncher, and a guy called Mike DeJohn. You may not know Mike DeJohn, but he scored the two fastest knockouts on the old Friday night fights. The older guys will remember those fights sponsored by the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports on the Friday nights, went from around October the 1st or the end of September of 1944 to 64, 20 years. And during that period of time, I think he scored the two fastest knockouts. 47 seconds to 57 seconds. He knocked out Alex Mitev, South American champion, and Charlie Powell, who used to play for the San Francisco 49ers, football player who turned fighter.
Oh.
And he knocked them both out pretty quickly. So, anyway, he was a real good puncher.
Obviously.
It didn't stop me from giving him a good beating, by the way. Actually, I knocked him out twice to win a 10-round split decision in the fight. I knocked him out twice. People would say to me, "What are you talking about, knocked him out twice?" I said, "Yeah, I knocked him out twice." And I was lucky to win a split decision. Before the fight, Muhammad Ali said he would fight the winner of the fight. Muhammad was just a young guy, then he was known as Cassius Clay at the time.
Right.
And he signed to fight the winner of the fight. And it was that fight on television, and I took the fight on short notice. Because Ernie Terrell pulled out of the fight with Mike DeJohn. just like when he pulled out of the fight with Muhammad Ali. That's how I got the fight with Ali. Anyway, Ernie pulled out of the fight. They called me to fight. I was living in Detroit at the time, and they called me to fight Mike DeJohn. I said, sure. So I go down there, and I get there on a Sunday. On the Monday, which is the Monday before the fight on Friday, I go to a press conference, kind of a press conference at a pre-fight medical, and the promoter of the fight, Bill Miller, came over to me and said, George, you want to fight Cassius Clay if you win the fight, because Cassius says he wants to fight the winner of your fight with Mike DeJohn, and Mike is signed to fight Cassius if he wins, and Cassius is signed to fight Mike if he wins, but he's also signed to fight if you win. Will you sign to fight him if you win? I said, sure, it's no problem. So sign it, and then he brings Cassius Clay over, and he was dressed in a kind of a brown striped suit with some stripes on it, a little bit of a pattern, and stovepipe pants, a three-piece suit vest, well, you know, the vest.
Right.
And I had a shirt and tie on, looked very preppy, like a preppy white guy, actually. And anyway, he was a nice-looking kid, and we come over, and so Bill Miller says, George, Mike's going to feel one arm, and you're going to feel the other arm, okay? He says, when he poses, he's going to pose. Cassius is going to pose, so I'm a strong man pose. So he puts up his dukes, like, you know, puts up his arms, and he flexes his muscles. And so Mike grabs one arm, I grab the other arm. And I said to myself, I want to have a little fun with this guy, because I know he's a bit of a braggart. So I said, how you doing, Popeye? He looks at me. I says, how you doing, Popeye? He says, why you call me Popeye? I says, well, I said, Popeye, because you must have pretty big forearms. He says, well, why is that? Because you have awfully small biceps. Remember Popeye?
You're right, yeah.
These huge forearms and little biceps. And he said, Archie Moore talked that way. Alex Mitiff talked that way. And Willie Besmanoff talked that way. Archie Moore talked that way. I said, yeah, but it's those guys, wouldn't he? So anyway, make a long story short, Muhammad, after the fight, said, after I knocked the guy out twice to win a 10-round split decision, said, I don't want to fight Shivalu. He fights rough and tough like a washerwoman. I don't know what he meant by a washerwoman, but if one saw the fight, if one remembers the fight back in 1963 on December the 26th in Louisville, Kentucky, I hit him with a hook to the body, hook to the head. He drapes over the ropes. He's 6'5". He's laying over the ropes helpless, and I pummel him, bing, 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 and he slithers down the ropes, knocked out cold. Oh. They stopped the fight, and they said they pulled him over into the corner, and they gave him a 5-minute rest. They said I fouled him. They said I hip-checked him. Like they called it cross-butting, like I was a Canadian hockey player, and gave him a hip-check. It was a dumb bunch of baloney. Anyway, they gave him 5 minutes to recover. And in the meantime, I took off my gloves. I took off one glove, anyway, and I took off the other glove, and I took off one bandage, and a short, fat, white guy, who was the commissioner, his name was Bob Evans, he comes over to me and he says in his Kentucky accent, George, what you all doing? I said, I won the fight fair and square. I'm not fighting anymore. He says, y'all don't fight. Y'all don't get paid. I said to my trainer, Teddy, put the gloves back on. So the fight resumed. I knocked him down again in the sixth round. He got up and I knocked him down again. The referee walks over to the up to my opponent, picks him up off the canvas. And the guy's staggering in the sub, weaving side to side, and he's dusting off his gloves, and he proceeds to give him a standing 8 count. Now, whoever saw that before on TV?
Right,
you don't see that. That never happened before. Anyway, make a long story short, I was lucky to win the fight because the two judges voted for me, but the referee voted a draw. It was ridiculous. I beat the heck out of DeJohn. Anyway, after the fight, Ali says he doesn't want to fight me. So sometimes people say to me, oh, were you afraid to fight Muhammad Ali? I said, are you kidding? I said, if anyone was afraid to fight me, it was him. You know, if anyone was afraid to fight anybody else, it was him against me. He didn't want to fight me at the time, but of course, there was a good reason for it. He also, what I didn't realize was at the time, as he pulled out of the fight, was that he also had a fight coming up with Sonny Liston. Mm-hmm. I guess he didn't want to take a chance on a tough fight, so I guess he figured if he fought me, it would be a tough fight. Anyway, he pulled out of the fight, and it was no big deal to me. So on the date that I was supposed to fight him, I just fought somebody else. No big deal. It was no big deal to me at the time. Anyway, he ends up fighting Liston. He beats Liston, beats him again in a rematch, and then Ali was supposed to fight Ernie Terrell. Ernie Terrell pulls out of the fight. They call me, and we fight in Toronto, and that was it.
Excellent.
Bing, bang, boom.
Bing, bang, boom. Now, George, as you know, an old boxing great, this is primarily a mixed martial arts show. What's your opinion on the sport of mixed martial arts? Do you watch UFC? Is that something that catches your eye?
I've seen a bit of it. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine has taken me to the first MMA match in, matches in Ontario.
Right.
With Georges St. Pierre.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very tough kid, very well-conditioned athlete. He's a very good athlete. And he cannot, you know, I can knock MMA if I want to, but I don't. The only thing I can say that doesn't really appeal to me is the fact they get in a hold and they stay there for a long time. And, you know, it isn't as exciting to me as it is to maybe some young people. I know a lot of young guys like it because it's kind of raw. It's kind of like a street fight.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's kind of repetitive. It's like, there's the sameness to it all. They fight and they can't box very well. Most of them can't box very well, but they wrestle. They can wrestle well. They go for the knees and they upend you and get you down and they'll bang, bang, bang. And,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's exciting. And the fact that they're in a cage makes it exciting. It's kind of there's a real strong appeal there. Like you can't get out of the cage. This is like life and death. And it's kind of like at some point in time. It's almost like people are like kind of drawing in their breath to figure and say that somewhere along the line here somebody's going to get killed. You know, somebody's going to get killed. That's what it feels like. Because, you know, but it's kind of hard. Even I was thinking about that. If I was in bare feet, walk and jump around, it's not the same as fighting with a pair of boxing shoes. Boxing shoes have a little grip on the mm-hmm. bottom of your feet. It's easy to slide. It's easier to box. And you're kind of limited in terms of the way you can move when you have to glide without a shoe, without a sole. You know, without the right soles on a shoe, which makes you easier to glide. And I don't know, it's a different sport, and it has an appeal. And listen, you can't knock success. They've been
That's
very,
true.
Very successful. A lot of young guys, especially young guys, like it. It isn't like a whole bunch of boxing fans have all of a sudden decided, hey, we don't like boxing anymore. We're going to be MMA fans. These guys are out there, the young males. You can see them at the fights. They're mostly all young people. They like it. I don't think they were necessarily big boxing fans before, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a new crowd. And anyway, they enjoy it, and good luck to them. It's MMA. Can draw the people. It's exciting to a lot of people, and that's what counts, and that's what sells tickets. When you have somebody also like in boxing, which is kind of declined in the heavyweight division.
Right.
When one considers that the heavyweight division isn't as healthy today as it once was, we don't have a Muhammad Ali, we don't have a Mike Tyson,
mm-hmm.
we don't have a Joe Frazier, we don't have a George Foreman, we don't have the kind of guys who can excite you anymore in the division. We have the Klitschko brothers,
right,
who box out of Germany, and they're from the Ukraine, and you never hear about a fight with them coming up, except after a fight you hear about it, seven lines about them fighting some guy that you never even heard of before. Really what the problem is that we don't have an American heavyweight champion, that we don't get the news. It isn't like the old days when Rocky Marciano or Joe Luis or Sugar Ray Robinson, Willie Pep or Muhammad Ali and those guys would fight. You would hear people talking about it in school. You'd hear people talking about it at the workplace. You'd hear people talking about it at the gym. You'd have people talking about it at a house party or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a buzz going on. People knew about it. People heard about it. And when you have an American champion, you know, it might as well be a Canadian champion because we're all exposed to the same TV stuff here in Canada and the United States. And so all this, you know, we heard the same things. We heard the same promos and the same build-ups, and if they had an American heavyweight champion in the world today, it would be different. But we have guys who fight in Germany or the Ukraine, and nobody hears about it. Nobody never televised till well after the fight, and I don't know. It doesn't seem exciting anymore. And the Klitschko brothers aren't exciting. They're somewhat lackluster. I don't like to knock other fighters, but I just know that they're not like Tyson. They're not exciting.
Right.
There isn't that sense of anticipation, that sense of something dangerous is going to happen, something exciting is going to happen. The sense of when you see, say, Sonny Liston or Joe Frazier or Muhammad Ali, they don't see that with those guys. So, and the heavyweight division is the boss man division. When you're the heavyweight champion of the world, you are the single champion of the world because of your size. You are, the big guys are bigger and better than a small guy. You have a guy 160 pounds, can't fight a guy 260, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Not going to happen. He'd get killed. But anyway, they're not exciting, and that's one of the problems with the heavyweight division today, is that they don't have an American heavyweight champion. That's what they need, or a Canadian heavyweight champion. Somebody from the West, somebody who fights in Vegas, somebody who's on TV, somebody who's exposed, someone who you can follow, and they don't have that right now. So, yeah, these are the guys from the Ukraine, and it's kind of, they're kind of like a mystery fighter, you know, and people aren't really tuned into it. So it's easier for, I think in that climate, too, it's easier for MMA to survive. It's easier for MMA to exist alongside with boxing, especially when the heavyweight division is somewhat lackluster today.
Yeah. All right. Now, let's talk about your Fight Against Drugs campaign. This is obviously an issue that really hits home for you. I'm always kind of skeptical when I see former athletes get involved in something like this, but this is obviously, you know, an issue that is really deep down, you know, affects your soul as you've lost family members to addiction. If you don't mind, can you just briefly share us the story of your loss, if you don't mind?
Well, I was married. I had a wife. And I had five kids, and seven of us in the family. But I lost three sons, and I lost my wife. So just my oldest son, my only daughter, and myself around from the family that way. So I've been deeply affected. And, of course, I always say what happened to my family shouldn't happen to anyone's family. And that's why I do go around the country speaking to young people about drugs, about the dangers of taking drugs, the dangers of even smoking cigarettes, which can lead to, you know, which makes it easier for a person today to do other things. Because once you smoke, you it means that you disrespected your body, because, and you're aware of you are aware of what can happen to your body today when you smoke a cigarette. You hear about it all the time. Cancer, strokes, lung disease, emphysema, all those things that can happen to you when you smoke. So when you know, when we read it on a cigarette package and get to see the stern warnings on there from Health Canada and what it can do to you, that, and you still do it in spite of it, you know that you have to know that you're disrespecting yourself. And once you disrespect yourself in one area, it's a whole lot easier to disrespect yourself in another area. If you go to a party one night, I would say to the kids at school, 10 of you go to the party one night, 5 smoke, 5 don't. Alcohol is served at the party. Which group of you would be more apt to try the alcohol? The smokers or the non-smokers? I would say in your natural mind, in your right from wrong mind, in your common sense mind, you know that it's the smoker. You know, it's the smoker that's more apt to try the alcohol. And once you had a couple of drinks at a party and someone serves you a joint, more easy to try the joint if you already had a couple of drinks, easy to try the joint if you already smoked tobacco. Step from smoking tobacco to smoking a joint, not that dramatic. And then they can go on to the harder stuff, and they go on to pills and to you know, like ecstasy and stuff like that, prescription drugs, and then they can go into crack, coke, or heroin. And people don't start out by doing crack, coke, or heroin. It goes through the preliminary steps. And more often than not, it starts out with a simple cigarette. So talk a lot about that. Talk about how important education is to one's life, how important it is to your future, how much better you feel about yourself and your health and your sense of self-esteem when you do well in school. Because even if you're only 14 or 15, you know when you do well in school that somehow you're guaranteeing yourself a chance at a bountiful future. But if you do poorly in school, you can't feel good about yourself. And if you don't feel good about yourself, you can't feel happy. And if you don't feel happy, it's easier to get pulled off track. The happier you are, the easier it is for you to make the right decisions in life. The unhappier you are, easier it is for you to get pulled off track, to make imprudent decisions in your life. So I talk a lot about being happy. I talk a lot about loving your family, how important it is to be a loving member of a loving family. I always talk about simple things like respecting your mother and your father, as it says Ten Commandments, honor thy father and thy mother. And when a young person does honor their father and their mother, they respect their mother and father. And out of that honor and respect for them, they end up honoring and respecting themselves in terms of making the right decisions in life, I think. And that sense of being close to your parents makes it easier for you to make the right decisions a lot of times in life. It makes it easier for you to think to yourself, I want my parents to be proud of me. I want my parents to be extra proud of me. I want to show you I can do the right things in life and be the right example one day for my own children, you know, as they grow up, as we all are examples for our children, our first examples for our children. And It's important to be close to your family. It's supposed to. It's the right thing to be close to your mother and your father. It's the right thing for a parent to be close to their kids. And when parents show love and the kids show love to their parents, when they hug and kiss each other each every day, they have that sense of that bond. Makes it easier for them to connect, easier for them to communicate with their parents. It makes it easier for parents to communicate with the children.
Mm-hmm.
Easier for the parents to because of that honor and respect, easier for them to talk to the young people about making the right decisions in life, about staying in school, formulating good enough work habits to get out of school into high school, into post-secondary education, all those things. And when you show respect and love to your parents each and every day, it's kind of like praying to God each and every night. When you confirm and reconfirm your faith in God and your love of God, it's the same thing with your parents. When you show respect to your parents, when you hug and kiss your parents each and every day, you show them respect, you show them love. And you do that each and every day.
Mm-hmm.
And as you do it, you just reconfirm every day that you do care for them and that they care for you. And it makes you feel good. It makes you feel good about yourself. Makes you feel healthy about yourself. When you have that kind of love and respect, it's easier for you to carry it out in the community. When you see a young person on a bus giving his or her seat to an older person, then you know that person earned that in the right place at home.
Right.
You know, a lot of things start at home. And one of the things is respect. And when you have respect at home, it's easier to have it out in the general community. It's easier to have it for yourself when you have it at home. Easier for you to make the right decisions at the most important time of your life as a teenager.
What would you say now to any parents out there who are watching their children struggle with addiction?
Well, I think that a lot of... In schools, there are places. Usually, there's the counselor. There's counselors in a school that can direct a young person into a program, into either a rehab, or they have places where kids get together after school and they have a kind of policy where they try to take care of problems with kids with drugs. If it's not there, they could also go into a rehab, and where would they be as a kind of an outpatient, and they have hospitals with that kind of a program. It varies in school, you know, from school to school or from city to city, but there are places where kids can go. They can talk to the police, and they will help you. They can talk to counselors at school, and most schools will have a place to send kids to get help if they need help, but they have to ask for it.
Right. How can people listening at home get involved with the Fight Against Drugs campaign?
Well, if you want to get involved, I'm not sure how you mean by getting involved. You mean if you want to find out about us, you can call Fight Against Drugs, or Google Fight Against Drugs, all one word, Fight Against Drugs, three words into one.
Yeah, fightagainstdrugs.ca is the website, right?
I'm sorry, hold on. Yeah, fightagainstdrugs.ca.
Okay, excellent. George, thank you so much for appearing on the program. You're a legend, a true inspiration to us all, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat with us here today.
Okay, nice talking to you. Take care.
And take care of yourself, George. All right, we'll be back to wrap things up on In the Cage with Bards right after this.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by SaveOurNet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to In the Cage with Bards on 101.9 CITR-FM. Thanks again to George Cheval for stopping by the program today. Always a pleasure to have someone of that magnitude on the program. And had a lot more to talk about on the UFC fight for the troops, but hey, I'm not going to tell the champ to be quiet. The biggest news out of that, Thamesford, Ontario's own Mark Hominick. He is now the number one contender in the UFC featherweight division and will be fighting Jose Aldo April 30th at the Sky Dome. I know it's Rogers Center now or whatever it's called, but it'll always be Sky Dome to me. He absolutely blitzed George Roop with a first-round TKO and came out of the fight without a scratch, and as per Dana White's instructions, will be fighting the champ April 30th. The main event saw Melvin Gallard full off a first-round TKO of his own as he upset Evan Dunham and moved up in his quest to go undefeated in 2011 and challenge for the 155 title near the end of the year. In heavyweight scrap, Matt Mitrione took out Canadian Tim Haig via first-round TKO. Mitrione looked great, had really improved stand-up. All the work with Duke Rufus is really paying off. Also in the heavyweight division, Pat Barry defeated Joey Beltran by a unanimous decision. Barry really didn't look as well as he might, but he was able to annihilate Beltran with leg kicks. Beltran was not able to have an answer for his pressure on that respect. And in a lightweight barn burner, Matt Wyman proved that altitude training does work as he absolutely just dominated Cole Miller with ground and pound, kept Miller on his back and on the defensive throughout the fight, en route to unanimous decision victory that way. On the undercard, which was streamed live on Facebook, the highlight there was Eve Edwards, the former uncrowned king of the 155-pound division, defeated the affable Alaskan upstart Cody McKenzie via submission in a rear naked choke in round two. McKenzie came out with a lot of guts and a lot of heart, but unfortunately there's no substitute for experience as Edwards was able to pull that one out. And former WEC featherweight champion Mike Brown, unfortunately not able to hold off Ronnie Yaya, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu ace, was all over him like a spider the entire fight and managed to hold Brown down and take unanimous decision victory that way. And this Saturday, don't forget that Strike Force is holding a card live on Showtime in the States, and also for anyone willing to pirate it up here, guess which group I fall into. The card is headlined with Nick Diaz taking on Evangelista Cyborg Santos, best known for being married to Christine Cyborg Santos, who is the Strike Force women's champion. Diaz looks to have all the edge in this one on paper. Santos hasn't exactly had a great run lately, but even though he's only one-on-one in the Strike Force promotion, gets the title shot, while Diaz will continue to negotiate with Jason Mayhem Miller for their grudge match. The middleweight title also on the line, Renato Jacare Souza taking on ruthless Robbie Lawler in a classic grappler versus striker matchup. Lawler says he's going to force Souza to stand. We'll see how that goes. That'd obviously be the worst worst choice in the world for Jacare, but we'll see what Lawler, the Miletic-trained fighter and now out of the hit squad with Matt Hughes in Illinois, can do there. Also, NFL former superstar Herschel Walker will step back in the cage, former Taekwondo black belt, also done some Muay Thai training and now training at American Kickboxing Academy out of San Jose. He's taking the sport seriously. You got to give him props for that. He'll be taking on Scott Carson. Not a lot known about Carson other than he's being brought in to make sure that Walker and the fans have a happy ending. And also the latest Gracie to enter the cage, Hodger Gracie, with victories over Kevin Randleman and Ron Waterman, among others, takes on the tough-as-nails South African Trevor Prangley. Prangley coming off, of course, that win over Keith Jardine in the Shark Fights. Gracie's toughest test yet. And I don't know, this one has got a sleeper quality to it. Could be a fight of the night candidate. And that's about it for me. I want to thank George Chavallo again for stopping by. Going to take you out now on a song that Mike Brown did enter the cage to this weekend. Didn't work out for him well. The song is Simple Man by Skinner. Maybe he should have been a little more complicated in his attack. Nonetheless, I'll see you next week, and the bell has sounded. ¶¶